The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
And now every Friday we invite somebody in and we ask them to guide us through the soundtrack to their lives. Today, on this Good Friday, we're in the good company of Nora Casey.
Oh yeah, how are you?
Good. Now before we get into it, you had met Liara McKee, had you?
I did, yeah. So most people don't know about me as I edited the Irish Post from the peace referendum onwards for about 4 or 5 years, very involved in Northern Ireland. And I'm still very involved in women's groups in Northern Ireland, so I've met her a few times. I have to say, I got a text at 3 a.m. this morning about her death and I couldn't sleep for the rest of the night. I mean, I was so upset, especially on the eve of a day like today. She had this capacity. She's only in her 20s, so very few people can do this. She can talk about things and explain things outside of Ireland that happened before her lifetime. That's the best way I can put it. The best tribute I could do to her today was to put out her work, her writing. She did a wonderful piece in Narratively about the about a massacre in 1971 where she was explaining to other people in the world the long-lasting impact that had, that it wasn't just the fact that it happened in the 70s, that for generations afterwards people were trying to find the truth. So yeah, I actually can't believe it. I think it's such a terrible thing to have happened today. I heard your opening comments and I agree with you. It's good to be reminded that we need to get the institutions back on track. I just put out a tweet about 30 minutes ago paying tribute to the women who were involved in the Good Friday Agreement, often airbrushed from history, Mo Molam and Monica McWilliams, who I still stay very close to, Betty Williams, Mary Carrigan. And I think on a day like today, we should pay tribute to them because women often work very quietly behind the scenes and do things that are very special and very different in conflict resolution.
Yeah, because last year, on the 20th anniversary on the telly, we had Bertie Ahern and George Mitchell on. Yeah, and it is the men who get
always the men. You see the photographs of the men, you never see the women. You know, I worked very closely with Mo Molam in London on the Irish in London. It was a pre-runner to the St. Patrick's Day Festival in London, which I set up with Ken Livingstone, and I chaired that for 8 years. But she was the first person to kind of invite me into the cabinet offices to talk about how we could help celebrate all of those Irish people who lived in London, all the great work she did in Northern Ireland. I gave her a Woman of the Year award in 2001, and to see all those photos, especially last year on the anniversary, not one mention of her.
Yeah.
Not one photograph of her.
I didn't know you. So you edited the Irish Post.
I did, yeah, 1998. I took over just after the peace referendum, actually, and stayed with it until I bought Harmonia. Like, it was part of the same group.
Right.
So Northern Ireland, I grew up in Northern Ireland in my heart. My father was, you know, very close to Northern Ireland politics, so it was very important to me.
Okay, so we'll your dad, Harry, and your mum, Mags, and you were born to them in the 1960s, you tell
us. Yes. Yeah, I'm a 60s baby. This is much you're getting, Ray. So. Let's just leave the blurred lines around that, okay?
You see, you made a mistake in talking to Neil.
Did you start working out the dates?
You see, this is it.
I'm a nerd.
No, me, I did. Oh, I'm a nerd. Because, you see, when I don't have information, I want to fill the void.
Oh,
see?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you anyway, just ruined Easter in my house by talking about sugar, by the way. So
sorry.
I have an after-eight Easter. I got on top of my cupboard in the kitchen.
Enjoy yourself.
And I'm still going to eat.
Enjoy yourself, yeah. Enjoy yourself. But yeah, you do mention that one song was in the charts when you turned 30.
Oh,
so I just,
you see?
Shouldn't have done it. Anyway, so 60s baby, born in the Rotunda, Harry and Mags. How did your parents meet?
So my mother's very cagey around this, but she was training to be a nurse in Grange Gorman. And my father, we grew up in the lodge in the Phoenix Park. So my father and my grandfather were rangers, constables. So his brother's 21st was on in the lodge. And my mother was training with his sister and they went up to the 21st party. And I think he wiped the eye of, as she says, some country man that was trying to take her out at the time.
Right.
She's from Leitrim.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So when did you realise that the house you lived in wasn't the usual?
Oh, do you know, I think not until I left it, because our whole life was the Phoenix Park. Literally in the morning, my dad had opened the door, we would go out playing and he rang the bell in the People's Gardens. So we live in the lodge opposite the People's Gardens, next to the Garda Síochána corner, next to Dublin Zoo.
Right.
So we ran riot, talking about dogs. We had a dog called Ricky who minded us all. He literally circled us all day. There isn't one bit of the Phoenix Park I don't know. Tree, branch, hole in the branch, rushes that I used to make cabins in, you know, things I used to climb on top of. We fished all day, every day, but not with anything normal. Like, we'd fish little fishing rods. I was constantly thrown into the duck pond and hauled back up to my mother. So
that was your back garden. Phoenix Park was your back garden.
Phoenix Park was my back garden. And you don't realise how special it is. My father was attached to the gates at the North Circular Road, but every evening he had to go down to, you know, maybe down to Chapel Lizard, maybe up to the Farmley Gate or Ashfield Gate. So he would take us on the bikes and we would go to that particular part or Island Bridge, and we'd explore all that area, you know, the 40 Glen and the 15 acres. And so it, to me, like, it's still home to me. My mom still lives there. My sister lives there. Richard's Bury there. You know, I mean, everything about my life is the Phoenix Park. Yeah.
It's odd because this is, you're probably unique in this sound memory, one of your first memories, and this is what you woke up to every morning. Put on those headphones there and see if it brings back memories. So this is a lion, right? And then you had a gibbon into it. So this is what you woke up to
every single morning, from early morning. The gibbons in particular, the lion call usually at night time at the dusk, you know. And but we, like, our house is just
Sorry.
A stone's throw away, and I'm a total animal nut. From the time I could toddle, I used to play with my friend's father, was the superintendent of Dublin. We used to play the baby lions at the back. I was constantly in Pets Corner looking after the baby rabbits. As time went on, every weekend, every evening, my mother said I used to just open the door, throw my school bag in, head straight up to the zoo and stay there till it was dark.
And why didn't you become a vet or something like that?
I always wanted to. If you asked me when I was younger, that's 100% what I wanted to be. I left school. I started school at 3 because I was, you know, just that odd sort of birthday. So I did my Leaving Cert at 16 and I couldn't go to college. So I went and worked in the quarantine section in Dublin Zoo and raised two baby gorillas. And I have to say, Ray, I spend my whole life doing animal conservation. Now I go to Africa for a month every year, just back from Asia. I'm horrified myself by Dublin Zoo at that time. Not now. It's an amazing zoo and it's, you know, conservation at its heart. But, you know, the polar bears and the tiny enclosure they were in.
Back
in the day. I thought it was the cutest thing to have these two baby gorillas, but they were ripped, not like the baby gorillas born in captivity recently. These two baby gorillas were ripped from their mother's arms out in Africa and ended up in my arms with a baby bottle. And I followed those two gorillas. I've written about them. One of them, you know, killed her own child because she didn't know how to mother. And I'm slightly, my father, who grew up on the doorstep of Dublin Zoo, never set foot in it.
Right.
He was a total animal.
So you're conflicted.
Yeah, he wouldn't set foot in it because he felt that it was completely wrong to have animals in captivity like that.
But it's unrecognisable from what it was.
Unrecognisable. And I
go up there all the time. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. All that sort of thing.
I have ex-boyfriends up there and all sorts. I spent my life with, there's very strong families in Dublin Zoo and, you know, generations of families. And, you know, if you're the family that looked after the lions, the next generation look after the lions. Or if you look after the snakes, the next generation looks after the snakes. We all know each other. And
who's in your family? Many siblings?
So there's six of us and I'm sandwiched between the two brothers. So I have two sisters above, one passed away, and I'm sandwiched between the two brothers and a sister below, yeah.
Right. So you were you sounded like you were a tomboy, were you?
Total tomboy. I was the leader of the gang. I never, like, you know, because I was living in the zoo, my sisters would be horrified. I was always sort of smelling of, you know, I'd pony poo or something by the time I came home. I de-liced pigeons, fantail pigeons most weeks, and looked after the stick insects, and I was constantly grubby and filthy.
You de-liced what?
There were fantail pigeons in a certain section of Dublin Zoo. My favourite activity was de-licing them. Yeah, they got this lice when they were in captivity. And you never want to ask me what I did when I was younger.
You didn't pick them out. No, you just spray them or something.
You don't spray them, get in their eyes. Of course you pick them out.
You pick them out?
Yeah.
So you just went through their feathers and picked out lice from them? That's love.
Yeah, I did. Look, my mum will tell you that a baby sea lion came in once that somebody picked up out in Lambay Island, and I brought it home for the night. I would never leave an animal in the zoo overnight that needed to be looked after. With the one in infrared lights, there was gerbils, there was guinea pigs, there was all sorts of animals in my house. Yeah.
See, I wouldn't have connected you. You know, because
I'm a total animal nut.
I always see you as this glamorous woman, you know.
No.
This.
And if you see anything, I go to, elephants are a big thing for me. So I go to elephant sanctuaries all the time. I've been out to ones in, I was just in Cambodia in the rainforest, and I go out to them in Thailand, you know, where they're saving the matriarchs and the logout. Massive interest in rhino poaching. I write about it a lot. So I'd say the other half of my life, all my life, has been animals. Yeah.
Right. Okay. TV, there was a TV in the house, and this was popular. Good. Food Around the Corner, presented by Paddy Crosby.
Yes, and he was... It's fair to say our house was, we never had TV on. My father wouldn't allow it, like except for the news and maybe for that. So we were out all the time, never allowed in the house. Don't even remember the TV being part of my, you know, first 10 years of my life. But I do remember that because I went to St. Hope Street School in Stony Batter and the boys went to Brunswick Street, Brunner, where that was, you know, where that emanated from.
Uh-huh.
And they all kind of were kids like us, you know. If you listen to the programme, I listen sometimes to the archives and the kids from Ballyfermot and the kids from down the road from us, kids from McConnell's, you know, you can just get a sense of what Ireland was like at the time. And it was a very simple little programme, you know?
Yeah.
Very simple.
Simple little country, maybe, were
yeah,
we?
Yeah. It was cute to listen to other kids, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we're on telly. We just play this in because was it you or your dad was, although he didn't like television, he liked Statler and Waldorf from The Muppet Show.
Yes. Yeah. He's a total cynic, my dad.
We put together, I think, three little clips from them, Statler and Waldorf. You know, the two boys, two old boys who were up on the balcony commenting on what was going on stage.
What was that? It's called the medium sketch.
The medium sketch?
Yeah, it wasn't rare and it certainly wasn't well done.
Well, that's talent. An opera singer who tap dances and sings cowboy songs. I wonder if there's anything she isn't good at.
Yes? Choosing what show to be on.
Hey!
Oh! What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
They were great.
My dad, like, you have to remember, there were eight of us in a three-bed lodge. I'm not doing Angela's Ashes, but it was always chaos. We were always talking over each other. And this theme tune in the Muppet Show, come on, you know, and in the middle of the final part of it, there would be a pause while those two would make these cracks. And my dad would shout, shut up, they're coming on.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the funniest part because they were so cynical. Everything else was all a bit cheesy, you know?
Yeah, we play a bit of the theme tune. What?
It's time to play the music.
Dun, 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 dun. And it was a musical family.
We're total. So my dad played the piano proficiently, brilliantly, and he played in a group with his brother. Played the accordion. They were doing the rounds of all of the clubs, and naturally, in our family, all of us learned how to play the piano. If you go into any of the Casey households, you'll see fiddles and violins and concert flutes and guitars. But as long as I can remember, my father played the piano almost every night. Got us all up, and we all had to sing sometimes together, sometimes on our own. Sometimes things like Two Little Boys, or yeah. There was one about a boy in an orphanage that was very tragic. Beside an orphanage one day.
Don't know it.
I'd say somebody listening
knows
it.
What was your turn?
So I did Will You Go, Lassie Go, which ended up being something, because I ended up going to be a nurse in Scotland. And the night before I went, everybody in the family would sing that and I would bawl my eyes out because all very Scottish, like, go back to Scotland, Will You Go, Lassie Go. But my father's favourite one was Good Night, Irene. And that's all I ever remember. We all sing it every time we want to remember him.
We have a recording of Eric Clapton singing it.
Yeah. I love Eric Clapton singing it. You know, in the case he has, we all belt that out regularly when we want to remember him. And especially there's some of the lyrics that I think are quite funny in relation to my mum, you know. So just even you playing it, I can almost feel a little
when
bit of welling
up. When did your dad die?
He died, so Dara was born in 98 and he died 6 months later. He died today, Good Friday, but not on this date.
Yes, yes.
So he died on the first anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement.
Right.
And went to sleep. He was 69 on the eve of his 70th. And he went to sleep and had a massive heart attack.
Right.
And he didn't wake up.
And Dara is what age now then?
Dara's 20.
20.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, he was a massive community man. You know, Ockham Street Church, if you know, you'd say, what was I doing here in my childhood? I'd be down Ockham Street Church in the Stations of the Cross today. But he was such a big, he was involved in the credit union, involved in the Vincent de Paul, very involved in the union. Obviously, everybody in the Phoenix Park knew him. When he died, people came out of the woodwork saying, my dad used to visit them in the community. He was a tremendously big-hearted man, but a total current affairs nut. all of us from a very early age, we watched the news at 6 o'clock. Mm. Nothing would happen in our house. We watched the news twice, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And then he would cut things out of the papers and he would make sure that we were up to speed with, especially Northern Ireland. Like if we sat around the dinner table, Ray, my powers of talking came from that, where he would start a conversation about something. And it could be Bernadette McCallisky, it could be an incident that happened in Dublin that day, and he would explain the background and then he'd sit back and watch us all discuss it, you know. I have a massive love of current affairs. No wonder I ended up being a journalist, you know,
yeah,
because of that.
Yeah, and 21 years ago, the Good Friday Agreement, and that's, I suppose, that's particularly poignant then that Liara McKee, you mentioned that earlier on, didn't you, that on the eve of that anniversary. So 1979 was a big year for you, and I read a piece that you wrote about it. But we've just put together just two of the big events from 1979. Mm. We'll play that in and then you can talk to us about it.
So he descends, the wine from the royal pope, the red robes of the cardinal, for his first step on Irish ground.
Young people of Ireland, I love you.
At Mullagh Moor, a mile from Lord Mountbatten's home, more of the wreckage has been brought ashore by Garda divers. Pieces of the wrecked 28-foot boat Shadow 5, which had been lying between 15 and 30 feet beneath the surface, a quarter of a mile offshore, and is now being reassembled roughly at a local Garda station for forensic examination. The shattered and splintered woodwork is mute testament to the severity of the bomb blast.
Voices of Colm Connolly there, and before that, reporting on the Pope's visit was Brian Farrell.
Yeah, 1979, maybe sometimes we have pivotal years in our childhood. The Mountbatten death, which was linked to the Enniskillen bombing, happened just literally a mile or two from where my mother came from. And in the summer months, we were all thrown down to Leitrim and Sligo, and we knew that area very well. There was a local boy involved in that tragedy. And, you know, I remember going to visit that scene, and it was the day of my birthday, 27th of August, that he died. And I guess it was just such a huge tragedy all around because it was connected to what was happening in Northern Ireland. It felt like Ireland was falling apart. That's the honest truth. All the way through my childhood, my sister had gone missing during the burning of the British Embassy. I remember my father out the streets searching for her, my older sister. I remember all those bombs and shootings that happened in Dublin. But that particular memory stayed with me because it felt like it was almost cataclysmic in my childhood. It felt as cataclysmic. And then suddenly the Pope is coming and he's saving us all. If you read the blog, you'll know that I spoke about the hair standing up in my neck when he said, young people of Ireland, I love you. And, you know, it felt like this man understood this chaos and everything that was happening in Ireland at the time. And I grew up in the Phoenix Park, of course, so my father was doing security duty, which was really stickers that he gave to people close to the altar. Everybody from my lodge to the Navan Road got a bit of free red carpet afterwards.
Oh, did you? Have you still got it?
No, I asked my mother where it got to. But I
that
also
must have been a huge. So you were in your teen years, and there's a million people on your doorstep.
So outside the North Circle Road, gates were locked, and I remember at 4 o'clock in the morning, my mother was trying to get us to sleep, and there were four girls in that front bedroom. And all we could hear was people outside. There were thousands and thousands of people all down Infirmary Road, North Circle Road. And by the way, they weren't just carrying a put up chair. They were carrying enormous picnic boxes and seats and blankets and rugs and all sorts of paraphernalia. There were babies in prams. And they had told that they wouldn't open the gates till 6. By about 5 o'clock, my father had to go out and open the door and open the gates. And we sat up at the window and watched all these people streaming past, going up and sitting there for hours and hours and hours. Now, if you read my blog, you'll know that with hindsight, I felt that it was one of the most damaging things that happened to Ireland in terms of the message that it put out there, the issues that happened in Ireland afterwards, and the rallying cry to us to kind of be the best Catholics in the world. Mm. So with a lens of, you know, age,
hindsight,
I can see that, you know, it wasn't the best thing that happened to us ever. And I was involved in the last Pope's visit.
But at the time, you were carried on that wave.
Oh, totally. I mean, there wasn't one of us who wasn't. He was like our superstar.
Yeah.
You know, not so much of the Phoenix part, because all I remember there is we were all in corrals, and even though we had a bit of an inn, like, because we lived there, it was miles. I remember sitting for hours in a queue to go to the toilet, and it was just uncomfortable, and you couldn't see him, and he was a million miles away. But then I remember him being on TV and saying those words, you know, about
young
people of Ireland from Ballybrit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was mesmerising. Like,
what sort of teenager were you?
I was so the opposite to what you might imagine. So I went in a Fianna to the Cayleys. I loved Irish traditional music. As I got to the age of consent, I went to Slattery's in Capel Street constantly, was a big fan of all traditional music, lived in the Dandelion Market, a bit of a hippie, I'd say. People say, what letter would you write to your younger self? And I'd say, listen to your mother when she says, don't get that perm. And above all else, don't let anyone photograph you in it. So I have these horrible photos of me with these huge, you know, hippie hairdos. I was addicted to Enoiga. I hiked and walked all over Ireland, all over Kerry. Every weekend, got a bus to Enniskerry and walked up to Glencree and Knockree. So walking, still stays with me. As you know, I'm trying to climb Carrin Tool at the moment, but I'm trying to climb Carrin. I have climbed Carrin Tool. I'm trying to do Kilimanjaro. But
and you broke your foot.
I broke my knee.
You broke your knee.
I am a good example of sitting on a couch and doing nothing. Last year, I was climbing Carrin Tool and I broke my kneecap, training to do Kilimanjaro. Got that fixed, started running about 4 weeks ago, and I shaved off a bone in my knee and I just had it fixed on Monday.
Ah,
I'm still going
sore.
To climb.
You're still
going to
go.
But you have to remember, my whole life was Dublin Zoo. I wasn't a makeup girl.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I was a hippie.
We're finding out a different side of Nora Casey today. They reckon it's nobody's child, it could be.
It is nobody's child. Yeah. That's it, yes. Very whingy.
We're talking to Nora Casey. She's guiding us through the soundtrack to her life. We'll take a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We're speaking to Nora Casey, and she's guiding us through the soundtrack to her life. So journalism came from where? You did nursing first.
I did nursing first, and I come from a long line of nurses. I don't think I knew what I was going to do. So a friend from the Park Lodge down in Park 8th Street, she had fallen in love with a policeman and was working in a hospital in Loch Lomond. And she gave my dad a brochure and said, they're looking for nurses. And I was 17, keen to escape the house and went off to train as a nurse,
And that sort of changed your life, because we've talked about this before, and you ended up in London and you met your first husband and that.
Yes, yeah. And nursing was tremendous. Like, I still think is the pivotal for me, foundation of everything that I've ever relied on in my life. You know, to be able to walk into a room and know when somebody's in pain, you know, saving people's lives, literally holding people's hands as they're passing away. Ultimately, it wasn't for me forever. And I did transition into journalism in my 20s. I did my postgrad in Harlow and print journalism, then did television at Ealing College. But in my early 20s, when I was just coming out of nursing, I met my first husband,
And we've talked about that before, so we won't go over that.
Okay.
We go to happier times.
Good.
And we play a piece of music, and this is from much happier times in your life. So explain the significance of that, if you will.
That was our first dance at our wedding, myself and Richard. And, you know, first of all, I'm a huge fan. Myself and John Sheehan picked up a Lord Mayor Award on Friday, so I met him again for the first time in about 10 years.
We're having him on after. He's not here, but we'd be on the phone after.
We'll say hello, because we had a great night on Friday and it was so great to see him again.
And you got a Lord Mayor's Award?
With him, yeah. And Christy Dignam. I mean, I wasn't the only one.
Right, is that for your work with the Magdalen Laundry?
It was, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I feel it was the Women's Award, not mine. But at the time we got married, we were living in London, and Richard was based in countries all over the world. There was times when I was in California and he was in Japan, and we hardly saw each other. So we wanted to get married in Ireland. So we did the University Church Shelburne thing, and we were trying to find that first piece of music. And he remembered listening to the Marina Walls. My father used to play it. It's a beautiful, I think of it as a very old Dublin. It just resonates with me, with the area I grew up in. It has that sense of maybe North Dublin. That's the best way I can put it. And it's a gorgeous melody. So we both loved it, and that's what we danced.
Your first dance to. How did you meet Richard?
I met Richard at a media dinner. During the day, he worked for the BBC, and we were both on radio. He was in the studio and I was in another studio. We were commenting on a case. And then that evening, we were at a media dinner and realised that, you know, he was the Richard Hannaford who was sitting next to me, who was doing the case with me. It was a case of a nurse called Beverly Allett who'd killed a lot of patients. She had something called Munchausen's by proxy.
Oh, yes.
It was
a very famous case
at the time. And as I was a former nurse and now a journalist and he was the BBC, they asked me to come on and comment on it, you know. So, we were friends for a year. That's the truth. And never held hands or so much as kissed until almost the year's anniversary, which was great because we got to know each other tremendously well. And I knew everything about him and his life and he knew a lot about me. So, yeah, I guess everyone chooses how to start a relationship. And for us, that was the right way to do it.
And you had very happy times with him.
Oh, he was. I still remember the day he told me he loved me. We were at a log in Richmond Park. It's in my diary called Log Day. And I celebrated quietly myself every year. But it was that magical moment when you're sitting with somebody that secretly you're absolutely head over heels in, want to spend your life with them, and they suddenly admit to you that they love you and want to spend their life with you. I mean, even though my wedding day was the best day ever, that log day is my private memory of like almost like floating with happiness, you know. To find somebody after, you have to remember, I had a terrible first relationship. I would never have put myself out there. I would never have dated again if I hadn't known Richard. And it was like, you know, for want of a better word, God gave me a terrible one and then gave me this amazing man, you know, who was.
Then he took him away from me again.
He did, but I still don't regret the fact because there's a lot of people who go through their life, Ray, who never get the great one. And I did get somebody who was amazing and wonderful and, you know.
That old adage, better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all.
And
you brought in
that.
A beautiful picture of Richard and Dara, your son. They're so alike. And Dara's listening today.
He is. Dara's very... Hi, Dara. He's very geeky and totally digital and, you know, laughs at me if I say I'm going to the Television Awards. What's that, you know? So he's not a radio listener, but he is listening today. And Richard was terminally ill when we took those photos. A great photographer, Barry McCall, took it for us. We didn't know Richard was going to die when we had those photos taken, but I'm forever grateful that we had that.
What age was he when he died?
48.
Right, very young, isn't
And it was very quick, Ray. It was literally... We were out partying with Mags Nelson, who you may know from radio, and Richard was singing and we had a lovely dinner with them, and then the next day he had a pain in his back and I was ribbing him saying, too many glasses of wine last night. And within 24 hours he was in hospital, and a week later, on his birthday, he was diagnosed with a cancer in his kidney. At the time they thought they would just take the kidney out and start chemo, but a couple of weeks later they discovered 3 in his liver and 2 in his spine.
Metastasized or whatever.
It was just spread. Like he was, if you saw him at the time, he was fit and he looked fit. He didn't look like somebody who had cancer. So it was so extraordinary in the matter of 2 or 3 weeks to find that he had cancer in so many parts of his body.
Yeah. That's the scary thing about cancer. And I ask people a lot about that, but was there any inkling? You know,
nothing.
That it's grown away
inside.
And
it was very aggressive cancer for him. Like every day there was bad news. And finally when it was in his lungs, they said, I remember the phrase, put your affairs in order. And actually the two of us drove away from James's Street and said, what does that mean? We were kind of knew what it meant, but we weren't prepared to admit to each other what it meant. So we drove back and asked to see the doctor again and said, what did you mean by that? And then she very specifically told us what it meant.
But you have loads of lovely memories.
Amazing memories.
And this particular song brings back some of them. Eliza Doolittle and Pack Up.
I love that. Do you know why I love that, right? Well, partly because it was a favourite of both of us. A year before he died, we were in the middle of a recession and magazines weren't going too well. And Richard and I had a mad idea. Neither of us had a gap year. So we said, why don't we go away for 4 or 5 months? And we went off to Asia with Dara, took him out of school, followed the curriculum.
What age was he then?
He was probably 10.
Right.
And, you know, we did lessons with him every morning. We followed the curriculum and sent a report back to the class every week of the Great Wall of China or whatever he was in. And I, you know, of all the things that you might regret in your life, I never regret that. That song resonated with us all the time during that trip because we felt like we were on our, you know, gap break as kids. We had, you know, all those months in Australia, New Zealand. We literally packed up the house because we were moving. And we had all this time with Dara all day, every day, time with each other all day, every day, outside of our busy lives. We went to Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, went to Cambodia. He had a friend living in Burma. We were one of the first people to go into Burma. And Darren and I just recreated that trip in January. It was something, Rich's best friend lives in Hong Kong and we hadn't seen him since the funeral. He'd been over and back, him and his wife and his kids were very good friends of ours. And all the time at New Year's Eve, you say, I'm going to get in touch with that person. And we never did. And here we were. And I said, you know what, Dara, let's go to Hong Kong. And we flew on New Year's Eve this year and we landed on New Year's Day, which is my wedding anniversary. And here we were in Hong Kong meeting up with Peter Wu, his best friend, and Dara's, his wife, and the girls. And we went off to Cambodia and Vietnam, myself and Dara.
You must have a great photo album, do you?
I do, yeah, digital. But I
do you look at
Dara,
them often?
Well, I have this thing that I've always said to Dara, which is called mind snaps. So sometimes we're sitting on the edge of an ocean in some magical place, Mozambique, I remember particularly. And I made him sit with me for about 10 minutes and I said, no photographs on the phone or on the
All
phone.
Right.
In your mind, remember this. Just remember this moment. Remember
so a mind snap.
Mind snaps, yeah.
So you make him work at it a bit.
Yeah, Dara, I'm a keen photographer. I was a photographer in my journalism days and I've taken an awful lot of photos. I used to develop all my own photography. So I do all my own photography when I'm traveling. And I have mountains and mountains of digital photographs, but I think sometimes your memory is especially if there's an, you know, if you have an emotion attached to a memory, it's in a higher drawer in your mind.
Of course
so
it is,
you always remember those magical moments, you know?
And, you know, grieving the death of Richard, very tough, but you did, you took a novel approach to it. Tell us about the 100 movies.
Yeah, I to be honest, it was pretty awful in the first few months. I mean, Dara and I were always upset. I used to drive him to school. I had this kind of thing that if we kept the routine, but literally there'd be some nights where he'd cry all night and he'd cry all the way to the classroom. And so every night I said, we're going to find something to laugh at. And I looked up, at the time there was all DVDs now, it wasn't Netflix, the 100 funniest movies of all time. And I ordered every one of them and they all started coming in from Amazon and we watched one every night and it was a 7 o'clock discipline. So we'd get in the door, have our supper, he'd do his homework, 7 o'clock. We'd put on John Candy in every possible guise, Uncle Buck, Canadian Bacon,
Planes, Trains,
Airplane. Yeah. Dara can still recite whole sections of Life of Brian. Right. Like I was laughing that you played that earlier on. It was like,
well, give it a second play.
Oh, just, I love
it. Let's just, it's only 9 seconds.
He'll be at home now, right now repeating that.
Let's see, I'll put it over here and play it. There you go. No, it's gone. Can we have that? Or no, yeah, it's try it again. There we go.
I love it. All Monty Python, anything with John Cleese. I would say the Blues Brothers became a huge thing. So we both got the hat and Dara got the sunglasses and we would listen to Rawhide. That section where, you know, all the bottles are just crashing on the chicken wire and they're going to have two kinds of music here, country and Western. It is the funniest scene. So we probably binge watched the Blues Brothers, I'd say 50 times.
Would you recommend that approach? It wouldn't
totally
work for everybody.
I'll tell you why. I had looked at, Yoko Ono had written about the fact that when John Lennon died, she practiced fake smiling when she felt at her most miserable. I started looking it up and realised there's loads of signs. I still do it. If I'm feeling miserable, I start, you know, doing this stupid grinning in the car.
I was only talking about it last week.
Because it's called a Duchenne smile.
But that, there's that book, The Art of Happiness, with the Dalai Lama and what's his name, Cutler. He's a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And the thing I took away from that was, fake it till you make
it. I can assure anyone out there, there have been days when I've had to speak at some big conference and I feel absolutely deathly and I grin all the way like an Egypt in the car. By the time I get there, I have tricked my brain into releasing the happiness hormone. So I knew that for therapy reasons alone, if we put on something, like literally we would go from bawling and crying, I miss my dad, and he had a little note on the fridge that said, the best daddy in the world died at such and such a time on such and such a day. It was a tragic house at the time. And then we'd sit on that sofa and laugh our socks off.
Brilliant. Now, let's see what they're saying. Hi, Nora. Enjoy and listen to your stories. Always admire you on the TV, says Darren. And love hearing Nora on the radio. Never fails to inspire with her fab can-do attitude to life, says Mary Kildare. Never knew Nora was a fan of the Gibbons. What an amazing sound. Oh, you want to hear that again? Yeah, yeah, you do.
We didn't like them at 5 a.m.
No. What a beautiful woman, Ray. I'm loving listening to her. She should be our next president.
Stop.
What a scope of openness and generous. Now, I asked you that question you didn't say no. You didn't say no.
But I tell you honestly, the truth is, I like doing what I do now. I can go up and go off to Asia with Dara. I look after things that I love. Like, I work a lot with domestic violence. I work a lot with homelessness. I can choose to work on the Magdalens event. And I think that just as a normal person, sometimes you can give value to life. You don't need to sit in Áras an Uachtaráin to do it.
Yeah. But you're not saying no. Like Nora, the Phoenix Park was also our garden. We lived in Arbor Hill.
Oh, yeah,
my dad, who was army, brought home pieces of the Pope's red carpet, and it was in our sitting room floor. Also went to Stanhope Street as well. Lovely lady to listen to. So there you go. That's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was great. I'm glad I missed the stations of the Cross and Ockham Street.
it would be lovely, sort of symmetry or to your life that you return to Phoenix Park.
Okay, so well, my
just
mother,
a slightly bigger house.
My mother always says, you know, I need to spend more time in the Phoenix Park, but you know, she means in the North Sickler Road lot.
And
I'll be up there this weekend, but not in Áras an Uachtaráin. Yeah, right. Definitely.
Enjoy your Easter, Nora.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.